You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, community-supported, live radio here from the Cultural District, broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa, with our solar power even on a sunny day.
I was going to say, solar power.
I missed that, didn't I?
Yeah, almost.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley.
A little discombobulated today.
Yeah, well, things were, yes. So we won't discuss the technical issues. And my co-host, Caroline Kilborn. We also have her good friend, Bob Stewart, in the studio with us. But he's just watching at the moment. We'll see if we can get him to say a few words later.
He was recently fame at the Sondheim.
Yes, anyone who went to see the marvelous Wonderettes at the Sondheim Theater in Fairfield, Iowa on Sunday, April 14th, Mr. Lee was played without any advance notice by Mr. Bob. And he took it all in stride.
Oh, yeah, he's a good sport.
Yeah. So, Mom, who is our guest today?
Well, this is a return guest, and this is Nancy B. Kennedy, and the book is Miracles and Moments of Grace, Inspiring Stories from Moms. Now, before we interviewed her in stories from doctors, and they were fantastic, and these are equally fantastic. The reason I like them is because they're short, and so you can read two or three at a time and then put it down, pick it up again. But it's just wonderful to read these stories. They're inspiring, and they will, what does it say? They will touch your hearts and lift your spirits. Now, Nancy is the author of two previous books in the Miracles of Moments and Grace series. We talked about this one. There's Inspiring Stories from Military Chaplains, which I'm sure was wonderful too, and Inspiring Stories from Doctors. And she has written a book of weight loss success stories titled How We Did It. She has freelanced for numerous publications, including the New York Times and the online Wall Street Journal. She has authored two children's books and writes articles and personal essays for books, magazines, and newspapers. And this, of course, is Leafwood Publishers. Welcome to the program again.
Thank you, Monica, and thank you, Caroline. It's good to be back.
Yes, we also want to thank Ryan Self of Leafwood Publishers, who always makes sure that we know what books they're bringing out.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
he's really on his toes there.
I know. I couldn't do any of this without his prompting and all his hard work.
So, Nancy, how did you get started with the Miracles and Moments of Grace series?
Well, as you mentioned, it started with the stories from military chaplains. And it all came about very serendipitously, the way these things do. I was having friends over for dinner, a husband and wife, and the husband is an Air Force chaplain. And over the dinner table, he just told us this wonderful story of God's provision for him when he was deployed. And it was one of these stories that it had to be God. It couldn't be anything else. And after he finished telling the story, he turned to me and he said, "You know, Nancy, we chaplains have hundreds of these stories." And I knew right then what I wanted to do, that I had been looking for a book idea, and I thought, that's it. I want to tell these stories. Many of them were just, although there are plenty of war stories, when I started looking into it, there wasn't much from the chaplain's viewpoint, and I figured chaplains have a great viewpoint. They're the ones that are seeing what's happening. They're the ones that are talking, having deep conversations. And they're the ones that have a perspective on these events that are just horrible and hard to consider.
Now, you say you were looking for a book idea at the time. Had you written books before, or was that your first?
No, that was my third. I'd written two, as you said, I had the two children's books. Since this is a book of moms, let me just start by confessing I didn't become a mom until I was age 41.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's tiring. Better to do it yourself.
Yeah, right.
But I had a full career. I'd, as you mentioned, I'd written for some national publications. And but then I quickly found out that the journalistic life does not mesh with the kind of motherhood that I wanted. And so I had to find another outlet for my writing because I just couldn't stop. And I quickly, in a couple of years, found out that my son was very interested in science, just small, simple science activities. He wasn't interested at all in arts and crafts. He'd had enough of these things in Sunday school and vacation Bible school and preschool. But once we started doing science activities, I thought, again, it was just one of those moments where I thought, I wonder if there are other kids out there like my son, and would they like to have a book of science activities that are geared toward Bible stories, that will help them remember Bible stories in the way that arts and crafts do. So I wrote those two books, and then there's always this moment of terror after I've finished a book, and I think, oh, maybe that's the last idea I'll ever have.
But now you know better, right?
Yeah, now I just have to be patient and wait for it to come along. The patience is the hard part, because I don't want one day to go by when I could be writing. But it was about the time we had my chaplain friend over. They were on their way to the U.S. Open, so it was September. My son had just gone back to school, and that's when my work year starts. And so I was a little bit panicky. A couple days had gone by, and still I didn't know what to do with myself. I think it was like September 8th or 9th when he said that, and then I was off and running again.
So it sounds like you have managed to create a career for yourself that really fits with your schedule as a mom.
I'm very privileged. I'm very grateful that, yes, I've been able to express myself in writing the way I always have and the way that seems essential to myself. But at the same time, I'm home for my son. In fact, after we finish this interview, I have to race over to the school and pick him up. But it works, and I don't feel that either my work or my child is suffering.
Now, writing by its nature is a fairly solitary activity, or tends to be. And so, you know, does that make it easier to do from home than a lot of other career choices might be?
Oh, definitely. That's definitely true. Yeah. I'm one who thrives on quiet and solitude. Some people would go stir crazy sitting in an office at home all day. I have another writer friend here in town. She keeps trying to lure me over to the coffee shop to work there.
I was going to ask if you ever write in coffee shops.
I can't do it. People do it. There's too many things competing for my attention. My son hates this, but I don't text. I don't keep my cell phone on. I don't want to be reached every second of the day.
You don't check your email every 5 minutes?
Well.
Okay, now the truth comes out.
Of course, nowadays, the process of researching a nonfiction book is very, very different than it was even 10 or 20 years ago because of the access to information that we have just sitting in our homes.
Absolutely. I don't even remember how I did my job before. I remember working for newspapers. I would have to go to the library. If I wanted to track down sources, I would go to the library, and they would have shelves and shelves of phone books. And I would be leafing through phone books, looking for experts, looking for people whose name I had, but I wasn't quite sure where they lived. Unbelievable. Today, the Internet, well, and particularly Facebook, it's like the universal phone book. You can find almost anyone you need to find.
And I remember the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature?
Oh, man, I haven't thought about that in a while.
Oh, yeah.
That was where you'd go to find magazine articles about whatever subject you were interested in.
Right, that's right.
I wonder if the company that published that is still in existence. If they've been able to morph into something that...
into something else.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
One of the online services, this is a brilliant idea that I wish I'd had. I find some of my stories through a website called Help a Reporter Out. And what you do is you post a query, and you know, thousands of people are subscribed to it, and if they feel like they can help you with your query, they will reply to it, and Helper Refer Out will send all the replies to your email box. And it's just incredible. What an incredible service. All I have to do is think up something I want to have some stories about, and they send it out for me, and every morning I sign on to email, and there's hundreds of replies.
Wow. Now, how do you sift through them to figure out which ones are going to actually be something you can use?
I sift through them one by one.
You have to read everything then, don't you, really?
Yeah, I feel bad. It's gotten to the point where I like to respond to everybody in some sort of way, even if I don't ultimately use their story, but it's getting harder. I need an assistant.
Yeah. So when you do that, the request goes out, and for example, for this, for Miracles and Moments of Grace, inspiring stories from moms, can you give us an example of a query that you sent out?
Yes, I sent out a query asking for stories for the book, and then I just had a brief paragraph of some of the examples of stories I might be interested in based on some that I've already gotten. I don't give the whole thing. I just say, if you want more details, if you think you might be interested, please contact me, and then I give them my email address. And then once they contact me, I'll give them the whole, you know, what it's called, writer's guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can choose whether or not to proceed.
Now, people who contact you might not necessarily have a story written already. They might actually write it to your, in response
That's right.
to your query.
My books are really an interesting collaborative venture. The stories can be written specifically for the book. A person doesn't even have to be a writer. I always state that they don't have to be a writer. I want the best stories, and if you are not a writer, I'm happy to write it for you. People will submit reprints. We'll take blog posts and fill them out more into more of a story format. It's really been a wonderful collaborative process, and I feel like I'm just one of 50 authors for this book.
Now, I did notice that quite a few of your authors in the little bio about them are bloggers. So is this the first time that this has been the case, that you've worked with bloggers a lot, and do you approach them, or are they responding to the general queries?
Yes, it's interesting that you notice that, particularly for the mom's book. A lot of the moms are bloggers, and I wish I'd had that outlet when I was a young mom. I was just grateful to have email so I didn't feel so isolated. It works both ways. Some days I'll spend the day typing keyword searches into the browser, and I'll come across blog posts that interest me, and I'll contact the blogger, or it goes the other way around. A blogger finds a query. There are, you know, several websites where they compile calls for stories, and they will see it and offer a blog post.
Now, for, you know, we may have some listeners who don't really know what a blog is. How would you define a blog?
I guess it's really just an online journal. It's a very informal way of writing. The blog posts are generally very short, 500 words or so. Most people chronicle, especially the moms, they chronicle their family life. Stories that might have before they were blogged, you know, in other generations, it's just something you told your family or something you laughed about with your friends. And now it's just got, you can get as wide an audience as wants to read your post.
Wow. Do you blog yourself, Nancy?
I'm not a good blogger. I do have a blog on my website, but it's a particular kind of writing, and
yes.
I don't know.
Well, how is it different from Facebook?
Not my outlet.
How is blogging different from Facebook? Isn't Facebook where you to tell everything you're doing?
Well, it can be. A blog is more of a little more permanent in a sense. I mean, well, Facebook, I guess what you post on your wall. I mean, you could use Facebook as a blogging platform.
But Facebook is even briefer. I mean, people aren't going to read a whole blog post on Facebook, but a lot of bloggers will post to their Facebook page and say, come on over to my blog and read my post about blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's a little bit longer stories.
You know, it's all a big, wide network.
I'm curious as to where the name blog came from.
It's a short abbreviation of web log. So like a ship's log.
Uh-huh.
So this is a web log.
Oh.
And that became weblog, and that eventually became blog, I think.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
And now there's vlogs, video blogs.
Right, where people actually do the same thing, only they're speaking and taking or filming themselves and then posting
right,
that.
Right, as a video.
Yeah. Yeah, our whole media picture has really changed very quickly, and we've been adapting to it very quickly. It's interesting.
I often think about this because I got a degree in journalism back in the ancient days of the 1970s, and I'm not even sure what I trained for even exists anymore.
Right. Were you an actual reporter?
I was both a reporter and an editor. I started working in a daily newspaper and worked there for a number of years. Put out a Sunday edition. I was a night editor. I loved that job, working like through the night and until 6 o'clock in the morning. And then I went to. I guess this was kind of the start of all these wonderful changes. I was sitting there at the newspaper one night after finishing getting the paper to bed, as we used to call it, and reading editor and publisher. That's another magazine. I'm not sure if it still exists. I'd have to look. But there was an ad for people. Did people want to work for Dow Jones? They had a new venture called News Retrieval. It was an electronic news database. I didn't even know what it was. But I thought, yeah, I want to work for Dow Jones.
I remember that.
Yeah. I put in my resume and got an interview, and sure enough, I ended up working at Dow Jones. It was a very early precursor to the online Wall Street Journal. It was an electronic database of all the material that was in the Wall Street Journal and Barron's, which was their weekly publication. And for 6 years, I abstracted the Wall Street Journal and Barron's for this database. And I remember back then thinking, oh, who wants all this information?
Yeah, we do.
You never know.
We are definitely living in the age of information overload, and it can be. But the thing is, you don't have to really remember where you saw something anymore, because you can just Google it.
That's right. You can easily find anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Writing a book like this, Inspiring Stories from Moms, I think would have been really difficult if I had attempted it 30 years ago.
I agree. It would have been very different. Now, you also have published stories in the Chicken Soup books. Was that sort of your inspiration for this style of book, where it's a compilation of stories from a number of different people about a theme that are inspiring and maybe a little tear-jerking?
It was a big influence. And it's funny that you'd say that, because, you know, coming from the Wall Street Journal and that corporate culture, I mean, I used to think, oh, Chicken Soup, what a bunch of hoo-ha, you know, a bunch of teary-eyed women. And yet when I started to write books and I'd have a little downtime between, you know, books or, you know, and I started to read the Chicken Soup books, and I thought, oh, I wonder if I could figure out how to write one that would get accepted. It was kind of a challenge to me. If I see something and I think I can do it, I really want to see if I can do it. So it took me a couple of tries before I got a story accepted, and then I realized what they wanted. And then when I saw what they wanted, I realized what they want is a very good story that can convey an event or a scene or a theme in a very visual way and can draw in the readers because it speaks to their heart. And there's nothing wimpy about that.
No. So what versions of the Chicken Soup books were you published in?
Well, let me see. The first one might have been... their weight loss book, Shaping the New You.
Ah.
It was 101 stories of weight loss success, and of course at the time I was writing my book, How We Did It, and one of the success stories was me having lost 30 pounds. So I wrote for that one. What else? Oh, they had one called Devotions for Tough Times. And I wrote a story about when my husband lost his job through a layoff, and how people were just so wonderful to us, and we just really we were just so grateful. We found out how people are willing to step up and help people in trouble.
Oh.
And then the third one, I just recently had one published. What's the name of it? It has to do with back pain.
Well, they're really expanding, aren't they?
With Harvard Medical School.
Gosh.
And it was a story about how I realized I needed help with my back, because it came to the scene in the park where my son was misbehaving and back hurt so much I couldn't grab him and take him to the car. I had to threaten him with a spanking, which I'd never done before and I didn't want to do, but I didn't know what else to do.
Wow. Well, that one would have fit in your inspiring stories for mom's books, too.
Yeah, that's right. I think writers all have these stories stacked up and looking for the right outlet for them.
Okay, so let me ask you, when you get these replies to your inquiry and you accept a story, do you have to pay that author for the use of that story then?
Ooh, you're getting personal.
Oh, sorry about that.
I work for a very small publisher. We're on a shoestring budget. I really rely on the goodwill of my writers. We can't afford to pay the way Chicken Soup does. So what we do is we give the contributor a free book, and then we offer them a steep discount on any other books that they want to buy. I also make it a point to point out that after each story, we have a bio of the writer, and so they can publicize all their other works. They can put their website address there. It's really a marketing opportunity.
Right. Yeah.
And then, of course, after the book comes out, I chat up all my contributors. I keep a Facebook page for each book. I have a website. My publisher has recently got me on Pinterest, which is a new world for me.
Well, just the idea that, my story has been published has got to be really rewarding for these people, I would think.
It is, and it's very exciting to work with writers. A lot of, particularly the moms, they were writers, they had wanted to be published for a long time, and this was their opportunity. And because of the way I do the books, it's not that I either just accept or reject someone's story. If I think it's a great story, I'll accept it, and then we will work together to bring out the very, essentials of the story and make it as hard-hitting as possible and just make it the best story possible. And I hope that my contributors like to work that way. It's kind of a learning experience for them, and it helps, over the years, it's helped hone my idea of what a good story is.
Yeah.
I do want to point out that Miracles and Moments of Grace, Inspiring Stories from Moms by Nancy Kennedy, who is our guest today, would be a great Mother's Day gift.
It would. It would
and
indeed.
Mother's Day is right around the corner.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's exactly why we were coming out with the book at this time of year.
Yeah. So, Nancy, why don't you read one of the stories for us today?
All right. I'd be happy to. I think you mentioned before...
Well, yeah, I was looking, and then there was another one, too, on the one about the cupcakes, which was kind of good because it, remember that one, it is on page 222, a working mother, a busy,
right.
Busy working mother.
That was one of the things I tried to do. I wanted a mix of working moms and moms who are at home all the time, and I wanted moms really to get the idea that there's not one way to do this.
Right.
I think sometimes in the Christian world, we're all expected to experience motherhood in the same way, and you feel somehow inadequate if you're not doing a good job at it, or you don't think you can do it that way.
Yeah, right.
Or don't want to do it that way. So, you know, I had 50 stories. I had plenty of opportunity. I wanted to make sure I had very different moms and very different stories.
Well, you do, certainly do, which is, that's why this book is a treasure, because you have a lot of different aspects of it, and people can say, oh yeah, that's me, you know, but maybe not.
Well, you mentioned, let me read the first one you mentioned, My Second Chance, because it's very dramatic.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, when you hear someone tell this kind of story, you just can't believe it's happened to someone.
I know. Yeah, that's true.
Can I just take a quick sip of water and you two chat for a second?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And we're talking today with Nancy Kennedy, the author of Miracles and Moments of Grace, Inspiring Stories for Moms, which is published by Leafwood Publishers. And this is the third in the Inspiring Stories series.
Great, I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm going to read My Second Chance. It's the fifth story in my book. It's by Jennifer Scott, who lives in Rome, Georgia. Oh, and don't let me forget, before we leave today, there is a story in here from a writer in Inwood, Iowa.
Oh, great.
Is that close to you?
I'm not sure where Inwood is, but Iowa's not too big, so...
It's not too far.
Well, I want to mention it before we leave.
Okay.
Okay, so Jennifer's story starts like this. I will tell you what I know of my story, a mix of what I remember and what I've been told. Truly, it's God's mercy that I don't remember everything. It's only by His grace that I'm here at all. My husband and I were so excited when we found out we were expecting. We'd had a hard time conceiving, as I'd been diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome, which meant that my body didn't ovulate properly. I chose to have hormone injections to encourage ovulation after other options had failed. One night, before going out to dinner with friends, I took a pregnancy test just so that I'd feel comfortable having a glass of wine if I wanted. And there it was, a line. It was faint, but a line nevertheless. At 6 weeks, we went in for an ultrasound. My husband and I both watched the screen eagerly, and suddenly I cried out, "Two! I see two!" My husband, who's a doctor himself, agreed that we were looking at two babies. Meanwhile, my OBGYN continued with the scan. Baby A measures such and such, baby B such and such, she said to the nurse. Baby C measures. Baby C, triplets. We laughed, we cried, we were in total shock. Of course, carrying triplets created a high-risk pregnancy. My doctor urged us to selectively reduce in order to lessen the risk. I knew what that term meant, and it was not an option for us. I felt good throughout my pregnancy, but eventually I was put on bed rest at home. At 23 weeks, I went into labor and had to be hospitalized and given intravenous drugs to stop contractions. I was in the hospital for 8.5 long weeks, where I did nothing but eat, grow babies, and get big. When I got to 31 weeks, the doctors decided to discontinue the drugs that were keeping my labor from progressing. They were concerned about my health, and at this point, the babies had developed enough to survive if I went into labor. Sure enough, my contractions started within a few hours of stopping the drugs. In the early morning hours, I was wheeled into the operating room for a C-section. My babies, two boys and a girl, were delivered at 2 pounds 6 ounces, 2 pounds 12 ounces, and 3 pounds 3 ounces. They were tiny, but remarkably healthy. Only one needed to be put on a breathing machine. After recovery, I was wheeled back to my room, sleeping on and off while my husband started calling people with the news. It got to be almost 8 o'clock, and I was excited about American Idol coming on TV. The first season, Ryan Seacrest. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't seem to shake my grogginess. I assumed it was the pain medications, but things rapidly got worse. "Honey, I can't get a good breath," I said, suddenly panicking. "It feels like there's an elephant on my chest." My husband wasn't alarmed. "She's just delivered three babies," he thought. "Of course she isn't feeling great." But to humor me, he took out a stethoscope and listened to my heart and lungs. That's the last thing I remember. My husband was shocked by what he heard. My lungs were filling with fluid. He says it sounded as if I were drowning. And then foam started coming out of my mouth. He yelled for a nurse who came in to check my blood oxygen levels. Alarmed, she called in a doctor who ordered that I be taken for a chest x-ray. But after years of dealing with critically ill patients, my husband realized that that would be a fatal mistake. He could see that I was coding, that I was going into full cardiac arrest. If I were taken to radiology, he knew I would probably die. This wasn't my husband's hospital, so he was powerless to intervene. He ran out into the hall and over to an OBGYN who was sitting near the nurse's station. "They're going to kill my wife. Don't let them take her to x-ray," he shouted. He begged the doctor to place me on a ventilator. Thankfully, the doctor agreed. The situation was so dire, they intubated me without even using anesthesia. They just shoved a tube down my throat. I was taken to ICU and started on drugs to halt my heart failure. The next thing I remember is hearing my husband's voice. He was speaking in hushed tones. I didn't know where I was. I heard a woman crying. Someone was holding my hand, but I couldn't move. I thought, am I dead? Did I die? I didn't know that they'd given me paralytic drugs in the recovery room to keep me from pulling out my tubes. I tried with all my might to squeeze the hand holding mine, and then I recognized my mother's voice. "She just squeezed my hand," she cried. The effort was so great that I immediately blacked out again. For the next 36 hours, I slipped in and out of consciousness. My heart wasn't pumping well. In fact, only a third of patients in my condition recover fully. One-third of patients die, and the other third live, but with severe disabilities. No one could predict which group I'd be in. They discussed whether a heart transplant might be necessary. My medications began to work, though, and I became more conscious with each passing day. Even in my weakened condition, it weighed on me that I hadn't seen my babies yet. My husband showed me photos. They looked like little baby squirrels. Their lives were starting, and I wasn't a part of it. To feel so disconnected from the lives I'd fought so hard for to protect was an agony worse than any physical pain. Little did I know that a covert operation was underway. One night at midnight, a nurse came down the hallway rolling an isolette. She had my babies. My husband arranged a blanket over me, and the nurse laid the babies down on my chest one by one. They were wearing bibs that covered their entire bodies and crocheted booties and caps that their great-grandmother had made for them. I was so excited to see them and to touch them. The babies were groggy, but moving around a little. I examined every inch of them, their eyes, their ears, their hair, their fingers and toes. From their appearance to their sounds and their smells, I marveled at all the miraculous little things new parents coo about when they see their babies for the first time. Mm-hmm. We didn't know it then, but I wasn't out of the woods by a long shot. A few days later, I came down with pneumonia and a highly contagious bacterial infection that forced me into isolation. I wasn't allowed any visitors at all, certainly not the babies. Even my doctors had to gown and glove themselves to come into my room. I was in the hospital for 9 weeks total before I was well enough to go home. It felt like an all-out assault on my life. But for those brief moments in my hospital room, cuddled up with my precious babies, I was content. I felt peaceful, and my racing heart slowed. Seeing them, touching them, our little family of five together at last, I felt for the first time that things were going to be okay. Mm-hmm. To this day, 8 years later, my heart doesn't work at full capacity, and I'm on medication for life. Yet I strive to live each day with the awareness that I could have missed out on all of it. Life is short, and not everybody gets a second chance. I got that chance. And I'm so grateful that God allowed me to stick around to enjoy the miraculous roles of wife and mother.
Oh, wow. That's great. That was great. Yeah. Great story. Yeah.
Yeah, Jennifer is one of the moms who blogs.
I bet she's got a lot to blog about with three babies.
Yeah.
And I think there may be 8 or 9 now. So, yeah, she's got her hands full.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, once she got started, huh?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's, the name of her blog is Lots of Scots. Her last name is Scott.
Oh, Lots of Scots.
Yep, Lots of Scots.
Oh. Yeah, that's right.
That's so cute. Well, Nancy, do you have a favorite story from your book? Or are you? Is it like you're not allowed to say that you have a favorite kid? Not allowed to say you have a favorite story.
It is so hard. hard when people say, what's your favorite story? Because absolutely every single one of them is my favorite story.
Right.
I could mention, some of your viewers might be familiar with some of the writers in the book, and then maybe I could read you one of the, there are a lot of humorous stories, funny stories, and maybe I could read you one of them after the very dramatic one that we just read.
Okay.
But two of the moms in the book are very well-known bloggers and also authors of best-selling books. The first one is Melanie Schenkel. Her blog is called The Big Mama Blog, and her recent book just came out, I think, maybe 2 months ago, called Sparkly Green Earrings. Is a bestseller, and it's about her life with her daughter, Caroline, who's 8 years old.
Aww.
And then another very well-known blogger is called Boo Mama, and Sophie Hudson is the author of that blog, and her book is coming out next month called A Little Salty to Cut the Sweet. She's a Southern gal and writes with a very Southern tone.
Oh, that sounds very entertaining.
So some of your listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with those two writers. Their blogs, you know, reach tens of thousands of people a day.
Wow. Well, Caroline, when you were when you talked earlier about how with so many different stories that almost anyone can find someone that they identify with or sort of a similarity, I have to admit that when I read the story about the mother who makes up little songs for her children.
Oh, yes, Brooke.
Yeah. I have two grandchildren who are about 7 months and 3 years of age, so little ones. And I make up songs now for them. Now, the younger one, of course, doesn't. I don't know yet if she really recognizes the songs, but the older one, the problem I have is that I'll make up a little song, like we're playing out on the swing or something, and I make up a little song. I don't remember it, but he does. And then the next time we're out there, he asks me to sing it again.
He wants it again.
And I don't remember how it goes. So so this last trip, and they live in Austin. I'm in Iowa, and so I see him about every 4 to 6 weeks. I go down for a week or so. So this last trip, I actually recorded the songs that I made up on my phone so that I'd be able to sing them when I went back.
Oh, see, technology to the rescue.
Very good, very good.
And then there was one song that I had sung to him over and over and over again since he was really, really tiny. I took care of him when his mom went back to teaching when he was just a few months old. I was there for a month and was able to spend that time with him. And I had made up this song then. And I didn't really know that he paid that much attention to it. He, as he got older, he didn't, when I'd sing it, he didn't really say anything. But one day when he was about two and a half, he'd gotten very upset in the car because we wouldn't let him sit down on the seat next to me. He wanted to sit next to me, and we made him get in the car seat, and he was just sobbing and screaming. And so I started singing a song to try and distract him, and he goes, "No, sing the Logan Grandma song," which is the song I had made up, which is, you know, his name Logan, and it has a part about Grandma loves you and so forth. And that was what comforted him.
Isn't that amazing? Something that simple.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very good.
It kind of strikes fear in my heart when my son was younger, and he would say, "Tell me a story." And he didn't want me to read a book. He wanted me to make up a story.
I know. It's hard.
I'm not a fiction writer. It's hard for me.
And then would he ask for the same story again later?
You know, I think I was lucky. He's one of these kids where he didn't want to hear the same story 100 times over. Move on to the next one.
Ah.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to watch Cars 100 times.
That's right.
So we talked about how, you know, whether you have a favorite story, but did you have stories that you really loved that you just weren't able to get into the book?
You know, what happens is after the book comes out, I'll hear from women who enjoyed the book and they'll tell me something a little bit about themselves. And generally, it's along with a story that I think, why didn't I have that?
Oh, yes.
I couldn't. Why didn't I find that one?
Well, you can always do a sequel, right?
That's right.
Yeah, sure.
Speaking of sequels, do you have some other books in the series planned or in the works?
I am working on the next one in the series. It's going to be Inspiring Stories of Survival.
Ah.
Survival has a lot of meanings. I have stories from, of course, adventure stories. One woman was on safari in Africa and got attacked by a lion.
Oh, my gosh.
One hiker was so exhausted that he didn't think he could make it down the mountain. And he got help from a mysterious person that could not have been there.
Uh-huh. We know who that was.
But I also have a lovely story from a woman. She tells about one time being on the school bus and being lost. She didn't know what stop to get off at. Her parents had recently divorced. They were living somewhere else, and she wasn't sure where her home was. And she talks about this being lost on the bus, but of course then she broadens it out to talk about how she felt lost because of her parents' divorce. Mm. And you know, how she finally found her way again. Mm. So survival. I even have some funny stories. I'm working on one now, hoping to get one now, from a writer who talks about going to Girl Scout camp and being part of a hard-boiled egg-eating contest.
Oh, my. Oh, just,
he ate 17, but the winner ate 24.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
Oh, gosh. Well, we will certainly look forward to talking to you about that one, too.
And will that come out about a year from when this one came out? Is that kind of your schedule?
I'm not certain. It might be a little bit later, but if any of your listeners has a story, all they'd have to do is go to my website and click on my contact, and they could contact me through my email. And my website is just my name, Nancy B as in boy Kennedy.com.
Wow.
I'd love to hear from anyone.
Stories of survival. And of course, I expect you have some that are survivors of various illnesses. Do you have some of that?
I have one from a man. It's one of these incredible stories where the doctor saw cancer. It was irrefutable. He was being operated, and the day of the operation, there was no cancer.
Mm. Wow.
Then I have a wonderful story from such a brave gentleman. He has had several illnesses in his lifetime, and now he's diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And he is telling his story of how it feels to be losing his contact with his loved ones.
Oh, how it feels to lose yourself, really, is what happens, isn't it?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Nancy, before we run out of time, why don't you read us one of your funny stories?
Okay, I'll do that. Are we running out of time already?
We are. Well, we've got about 12 minutes.
Okay. This is just a brief one. It's called If Only I Spoke Bug.
Oh, that's a good one.
And the writer is Ginger Lyons. She lives in Spokane, Washington. She was one of the writers that you mentioned who had always, this was one of her, on her bucket list, she wanted to be a writer.
Oh.
And this was the first time her name has appeared in a book.
Oh, wonderful.
All right, here's Ginger's story. You're my best friend. I love you. This declaration of love came from my 2-year-old son, Dylan. The object of his affection? Not me, but a caterpillar. For more than an hour, Dylan had been playing with the fuzzy little caterpillar in his great-grandparents' backyard. Thanks to Dylan, the caterpillar was now doing things that it had never, and I'm just guessing here, done before. Learned to crawl up a very dirty little boy's toes, and survived a trip sailing through the air. He'd attempted to eat a gummy worm, and had even played a rousing game of Ring Around the Rosie. Anticipating a teaching moment and feeling a sense of parental obligation, my husband explained to Dylan that this lowly little caterpillar would one day become a beautiful butterfly, and after that, he'd be able to fly and do all kinds of exciting things. Dylan stared at the greenish-brown critter as it inched its way across his hand. "But he's beautiful now, Daddy," he said, "and he can fly already. Watch." Once again, the fuzzy creature went sailing through the air. Dylan and the caterpillar lay contentedly side by side on the concrete patio, with the sun's rays beating down on them, blissfully unaware of the sudden shadow falling over them. An instant later, the caterpillar was squashed, and Dylan's big brother, the bottom of his shoe to be precise, was the assailant. A brutal scene. "Call the ambulance," Dylan screamed, while his big brother protested loudly, "It was an accident." In the midst of the mayhem, Daddy grabbed a tissue and respectfully removed the carcass from the scene. As I comforted both boys and attempted to prevent another untimely death, I thought of Caterpillar's mother. If I spoke Bug, I would tell her what I learned from my son and hers that day. We're beautiful now. With his innocent observation, Dylan had taken my breath away. After 32 years on Earth, I needed my 2-year-old to explain the meaning of life to me. I'm constantly worrying about the future, where I'll go, what I'll do, what my children will do, what they'll become. But God is happy with us now. He thinks we're beautiful now. Yes, if I were able, I would tell that caterpillar mama that her gentle offspring was well-loved to the final moment of his life, and that he did not die in vain. Aww. Tell her of the life-changing lesson I learned from my son and his fuzzy little companion that day. I comforted Dylan on the loss of his best friend for well over 3 minutes as his tears fell, but then he lifted his head and spotted something out of the corner of his eye. "Come here, Buggy," Dylan shrieked at an innocent little quick beetle.
Aww.
I sighed, sent up a prayer for the beetle mom.
That's great. It really is.
Now, you say that the author of this, Ginger Lyons, was this was sort of the fulfillment of her goal to be a published writer, but she has not just one, but 2 stories in your book.
Oh, my goodness, you've looked closely.
Yes, I have. So she must be very proud.
Yes, and she's so talented. She has a couple of shops in Spokane, and she's very artistic, and she sells vintage articles, and I know she's selling the book in her shops.
Oh.
It was unusual. I think maybe in the doctor book I had one doctor that had 2 stories, but in this case I just couldn't choose between the two. The other one, she writes about, I can't see it right now.
It's Dare to Be Different on page 179.
Oh, that's right. Right. She writes about her other son.
Right, and it's a very touching story. The first, here's another one that speaks to me. The opening line is, congratulations, your son has the biggest head ever born to a woman in this hospital. Which my son also had a very large head. Now, they didn't tell me it was the biggest ever, but it was quite big.
Did it feel like it was the biggest ever?
Yeah. It was unusually large.
Oh, it's funny what we remember from our... Every mother remembers her childbirth experience.
Yes, yeah. I have a great story, childbirth story on my daughter, because... we had just moved away from family, away from everyone, when I was 8 months pregnant. And the doctor moved into this little town north of Iowa called Solon. And the doctor was a brand new doctor, had just graduated from medical school. The town had sort of brought him there. They didn't have a doctor in the town, and they had brought him there and set up a clinic so that they would have a doctor. But they were only 15 miles from Iowa City, which is, you know, has a lot of hospitals and so forth. So he had never delivered a baby on his own. And his wife was also pregnant. So he was really into, and he didn't have very many patients. So here I was, 8 months, a brand new doctor, but it was his first ever.
My.
His first ever. Well, the day after Christmas, we had come back to Fairfield to visit my parents for Christmas. Went home, got home very late. I had a 3-year-old son. My husband got up the day after, went on a job about 80 miles away. He was doing construction. I woke up and realized that I was in labor at 9:30 in the morning. And I had a doctor appointment at 10:30, so I got my neighbor to run me over to the doctor. He took one look at me, said, "You're in labor," and he drove me to the hospital.
Oh, the doctor.
The doctor drove me to the hospital, and we barely made it.
Oh, my.
So we got to the hospital after 11 a.m., and she was born before noon. So that's my childbirth story. So the first baby he ever delivered was when I was done, he said, "Boy, that was easy."
Yeah, for you.
That's exactly what I said.
Now, before we run out of time, I do want to mention that author who lives in Inwood, Iowa.
Oh, yes.
Her name is Jennifer Dukes Lee, and her story is called The Red Apple. And she talks about struggling with postpartum depression with her second child, but how she ultimately finds that the Lord gives her enough grace for each day. Mm. And I love Jennifer. We share an agent, and she also has a book coming out, I think, in 2014. So some of your listeners might recognize her name as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. Well, we still do have a few minutes. What should we talk about?
Well, once again,
my childbirth story.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
My doctor, I was part of an HMO, and it was going under. It was failing. Mm. And just that day, my doctor had gotten her pink slip, so she wasn't going to be working for them any longer. So she had nothing to do, but so she just hung out with me all day. And my labor didn't go as fast as yours.
Oh.
We spent a good long time together, and I remember one time she was sitting in the room with a nurse and an aide or something, and they all started talking about their childbirth experiences, and I'm laying in the bed in pain and thinking, hey, this is my experience.
Hey, yeah, pay attention to me.
Be quiet already.
Oh, gosh. Now, well, you also have a couple stories yourself in this book. One's in the introduction, and I love that. I love that story. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yes, I do have two stories about my son, the one in the introduction where I talk about that wonderful moment of connection between us at Legoland.
Yep.
Where I thought, you know, I really, really do not like amusement parks, and I thought I was going to be miserable. But we had a beautiful moment when he was just so happy that you could not be happy with him. And then I have a story later in the book. My son's passion is baseball. And so I tell a very funny story about when he was about 4 years old and we were out in the backyard playing baseball. And I thought I'd hurt him by batting a ball into his arm. And I went over to rub his arm and be a mother and coo and all that good stuff, and then he turns, he wheels around, and I think, oh no, he's mad at me, he's stalking away, but he goes over to the first base, picks up the ball, brings it back, touches it to my arm, and he says, "You're out, Mom." He didn't care anything for what I was doing. He was just, the ball was still in play.
That's a good one.
That is a good Nancy, one. Is your, how old is your son now?
He's now 14.
Okay, so here's my question. How does he feel about you writing these stories about him as a little child?
Mm.
Is he embarrassed? Do you have to get his permission to publish it?
I do tell him when I am planning to write about him, and generally the stories are stories that we've talked about. You know, they become family stories, part of your family lore. So he doesn't mind. I often wonder how bloggers do it, because they're on a daily basis talking about their children and what their children have done. And I think, my son is much more private than that.
Oh, yeah.
He would not like that at all.
There's a website where people submit instances of parents who have just given too much information publicly on Facebook or whatever, and I've seen some of these Mm-hmm. And sometimes people realize themselves that they did it and submit it to the site, which just makes it even worse because then even more people see it. But some people don't have a filter.
And I'm hoping that someday he'll just appreciate them. My books is, you know, just part of our family story.
Oh, yeah. And is he proud of you as a mom who's a published writer?
I don't think kids think that way. I think he's happy that I can pick him up after baseball practice.
That's
right.
A good point.
That's right.
A good point.
Well, once again,
although
this
he is, I must say, I'm proud of him. He's in the honors English program in high school. I try not to press my interests on him, but that makes my heart proud.
Oh. Good. Well, this book once again would make a wonderful Mother's Day. It'll make a wonderful present anytime.
Yep.
Moments of
Miracles and Moments
of Grace by Nancy B. Kennedy, and that is Leafwood Publishers.
And is it available at normal bookstores?
Yes, any Barnes & Noble, online, Amazon, and I know that at least two of the Christian bookstore chains are featuring it this month, Lifeway and Family Christian.
Great.
Okay.
Well,
good.
Thank you again for being with us, and we look forward to your next book, Nancy.
Well, thank you for having me on the show again. I always enjoy it.
It was great.
So do we.
It really was.
So do we.
I got a super, super outtake.
Okay. What is it?
We worry about what a child will be tomorrow, yet we forget that he or she is someone today.
Exactly. Stay tuned now. If you're listening to us on Friday on our live broadcast, stay tuned for Planet Erstwhile. James Moore is up next. He will be presenting live music by 350 Duo, who are playing at Cafe Paradiso here in Fairfield this weekend. And then at 3 p.m., it's a live phone interview with Fred Bronfman, whose recent piece in Alternate on Henry Kissinger highlights the man responsible for killing, wounding, or displacing some 6 million people in Indochina. So that may be a somewhat controversial subject, which James will handle with grace and aplomb, as always. And at 4 p.m., he goes to Inside the Headlines with news vandal J.P. Sotillo. I always try and catch at least a little bit of that because it is so fascinating. And see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.